happen? In truth, it was difficult for the outrageous dwarven warrior to ignore those tempting sounds of battle, but Pwent found his heart seeking the promise of greater enemies, of drow and minotaurs, in the open corridors the other way.
"And if we get stuck in that tunnel there,"
Pwent continued, pointing back toward what remained of Tunnel's cavern,
"the damned drow will walk right up our backs."
The Gutbuster Brigade formed up behind their leader, but Bitterdew shook his head and squeezed into the passage. His worst fears were quickly realized, for it did indeed narrow, and he could not get near the open area beyond, where the fighting continued, could not even get close enough to hope to attract attention above the tumult of battle. Perhaps he had a spell that would aid him, Bitterdew reasoned, and he reached into an impossibly deep pocket to retrieve his treasured spellbook. He pulled out a lump of ruffled pages, smeared and singed, many with ink blotched from the intense heat. The glue and stitches in the binding, too, had melted, and when Bitterdew held the mess up, it fell apart. The wizard, breathing hard suddenly, feeling as if the world were closing in on him, gathered together as many of the parchments as he could and scrambled back out of the passageway to find, to his surprise and relief, Pwent and the others still waiting for him.
"Figured you'd change your mind,"
the Battle Rager remarked, and he led the Gutbuster Brigade, plus one, away.
50 drow, and an entire minotaur grouping, Quentha Bayenri's hands flashed, and from the sharp, jerking movements her mother knew she was outraged.
Fool, Matron Bayenri mused. She wondered then about her daughter's heart for this expedition. Quentha was a powerful priestess, there could be no denying that. But only then did the withered old matron mother realize that young Quenthel had never really seen battle. House Bayenri had not warred in many hundreds of years, and because of her accelerated education through the academy, Quenthel had been spared the duties of escorting scouting patrols in the wild tunnels outside Menzo Berenzon. It struck Bayenri then that her daughter had never even been outside the Drow City.
"The primary way to Mithril Hall is no more," Quenthel's hands went on. "And several paralleling passages have fallen as well, and worse."
Quenthel stopped abruptly, had to pause and take a deep breath to steady herself. When she began again, her face was locked in a mask of anger.
"Many of the dead drow were females, several powerful priestesses, and one a high priestess."
Still the movements were exaggerated, too sharp and too quick. Did Quenthel really believe this conquest would be easy? Bayenri wondered. Did she think no drow would be killed? Bayenri wondered, and not for the first time, whether she had erred in bringing Quenthel along. Perhaps she should have brought Triel, the most capable of priestesses. Quenthel studied the hard look that was coming at her, and understood that her mother was not pleased. It took her a moment to realize she was irritating Bayenri more than the bad report would warrant.
"The lines are moving?" Bayenri asked aloud.
Quenthel cleared her throat.
"Bregan de Aerith has discovered many other routes," she answered. "Even corridors the dwarves do not know about, which come close to tunnels leading to Mithril Hall."
Matron Bayenri closed her eyes and nodded, approving of her daughter's suddenly renewed optimism. There were indeed tunnels the dwarves did not know about, small passages beneath the lowest levels of Mithril Hall, lost as the dwarves continued to shift their mining operations to richer veins. Old Gandalug knew those ancient secret ways, though, and with Methil's intrusive interrogation, the drow knew them as well. These secret tunnels did not actually connect to the dwarven compound, but wizards could open doors where there were none, and illithids could walk through stone, and could take drow warriors with them on their psionic journeys. Bayenri's eyes popped open.
"Word from Bergignon?" she asked.
Quenthel shook her head.
"He exited the tunnels as commanded, but we have not heard since."
Bayenri's features grew cross. She knew that Bergignon was outwardly pouting at being sent outside. He led the greatest cohesive unit of all, numerically speaking, nearly 1,000 drow and 5 times that in goblins and kobolds, with many of the dark elves riding huge lizards. But Bergignon's duties, though vital to the conquest of Mithril Hall, put him on the mountainside outside the dwarven complex. Very likely, Drisdoerden would be inside, in the lowest tunnels, working in an environment more suited to a dark elf. Very likely, Euthagentol Armgo, not Bergignon, would get first try at the renegade. Bayenry's scowl turned to a smile as she considered her son and his tantrum when she had given him his assignment. Of course he had to act angry, even outraged. Of course he had to protest that he, not Euthagentol, should spearhead the assault through the tunnels. But Bergignon had been Drizzt's classmate and primary rival in their years at Mele Magvir, the drow school for fighters. Bergignon knew Drizzt perhaps better than any living drow in Menzo Berenzon, and Matron Bayenry knew Bergignon. But truth of it was, Bergignon didn't want anything to do with the dangerous renegade.
"Search out your brother with your magic," Bayenry said suddenly, startling Quenthel. "If he continues his obstinacy, replace him."
Quenthel's eyes widened with horror. She had been with Bergignon when the force had exited the tunnels, crossing out onto a ledge on a mountain overlooking a deep ravine. The sight had overwhelmed her, had dizzied her, and many other drow as well. She felt lost out there, insignificant and vulnerable. This cavern that was the surface world, this great chamber whose black dome sparkled with pinpoints of unknown light, was too vast for her sensibilities. Matron Bayenry did not appreciate the horrified expression.
"Go!"
she snapped, and Quenthel quietly slipped away. She was hardly out of sight before the next reporting drow stepped before Bayenry's blue-glowing drift disk. Her reports of the progress of the force moving secretly in the lower tunnels was better, but Bayenry hardly listened. To her, these details were fast becoming tedious. The dwarves were good and had many months to prepare, but in the end, Matron Bayenry did not doubt the outcome, for she believed that Loth herself had spoken to her. The drow would win, and Mithril Hall would fall. She listened to the report, though, and to the next, and the next, and the next after that, a seemingly endless stream, and forced herself to look interested. Chapter 22 Starlight, Starbright. From her high perch, her eyesight enhanced by magical Dwyamers, they seemed an army of ants, swarming over the eastern and steepest side of the mountain, filling every vale, clambering over every rock. Filtering behind in tight formations came the deeper blackness, the tight formations of drow warriors. Never had the Lady of Silvery Moon seen such a disconcerting sight. Never had she been so filled with trepidation, though she had endured many wars and many perilous adventures. Alustriel's visage did not reflect those battles. She was as fair as any woman alive, her skin smooth and pale, almost translucent, and her hair long and silvery, not gray with age, though she was indeed very old, but lustrous and rich, the quiet light of night and the sparkling brightness of stars all mixed together. Indeed, the fair lady had endured many wars, and the sorrow of those conflicts was reflected in her eyes, as was the wisdom to despise war. Across the way toward the southern face, around the bend of the conical mountain, Alustriel could see the banners of the gathered forces, most prominent among them the silver flag of her own knights. They were proud and anxious, Alustriel knew, because most of them were young and did not know grief. The Lady of Silvery Moon shook away the disconcerting thoughts and focused on what likely would transpire, what her role might be. The bulk of the enemy force was kobolds, and she figured that the huge barbarians and armored riders should have little trouble in scattering them. But how would they fare against the drow? Alustriel wondered. She brought her flying chariot in a wide loop, watching and waiting. Skirmishes erupted along the point line as human scouts met the advancing kobolds. At the sound of battle, and with reports filtering back, Berkthgar was anxious to loose his forces, to charge off to fight and die with a song to Tempest on his lips. Besnel, who led the knights in silver, was a tempered fighter and more the strategist.
"Hold your men in check," he bade the eager barbarian. "We will see more fighting this night than any of us, even Tempest, your god of battle, would enjoy. Better that we fight them on the ground of our choosing." Indeed, the knight had been careful in selecting that very ground, and had argued against both Berkthgar and King Brunner himself to win over their support for his plan. The forces had been broken into four groups, spaced along the south side of the mountain, Fourth Peak, which held both entrances to Mithril Hall. Northwest around the mountain lay Keeper's Dale, a wide, deep, rock-strewn and mist-filled valley, wherein lay the secret western door to the dwarven complex. From the soldiers' positions northeast around the mountain, across wide expanses of open rock and narrow crisscrossing trails, lay the longer, more commonly used path to Mithril Hall's eastern door. Brunner's emissaries had wanted the force to split, the riders going to defend Keeper's Dale, and the men of Settlestone guarding the eastern trails. Besnel had held firm his position, though, and had enlisted Berkthgar by turning the situation back on the proud dwarves, by insisting that they should be able to conceal and defend their own entrances. "If the drow know where the entrances lie," he had argued, "then that is where they will expect resistance."
Thus, the south side of Fourth Peak was chosen. Below the positions of the defenders the trails were many, but above them the cliffs grew much steeper, so they expected no attack from that direction. The defenders' groups were mixed according to terrain, one position of narrow, broken trails exclusively barbarians, two having both barbarians and riders, and one, a plateau above a wide, smooth, gradually inclined rock face comprised wholly of the riders of Nesme. Besnel and Berkthgar watched and waited now from the second position. They knew the battle was imminent. The men around them could feel the hush, the crouch of the approaching army. The area lower on the mountain, to the east, exploded suddenly in bursts of shining light as a rain of enchanted pellets, gifts from dwarven clerics, came down from the barbarians of the first defense. How the kobolds scrambled! As did the few dark elves among the diminutive creatures' front ranks. Those monsters highest on the face, near the secret position, were overwhelmed. A horde of mighty barbarians descending over them, splitting them in half with huge swords and battle axes, or simply lifting the kobolds high overhead and hurling them down the mountainside.
"We must go out and meet them,"
Berkthgar roared, seeing his kin engaged. He raised huge Bunk and Fuera high into the air.
"To the glory of Tempest," he roared, a cry repeated by all those barbarians on the second position, and those on the third as well.
"So much for the ambush,"
muttered Regveld Harple, seated on his horse-frog puddle-jumper. With a nod to Besnel, for the time drew near, Regveld gave a slight tug on puddle-jumper's rein, and the weird beast croaked out a guttural whinny and leaped to the west, clearing 30 feet.
"Not yet," Besnel implored Berkthgar, the barbarian's hand cupping a dozen or so of the magic light-giving pellets.
The knight pointed out the movements of the enemy force below, explained to Berkthgar that, while many climbed up to meet the defenders holding the easternmost position, many, many more continued to filter along the lower trails to the west. Also, the light was not so intense anymore, as dark elves used their innate abilities to counter the stingingly bright enchantments.
"What are you waiting for?" Berkthgar demanded.
Besnel continued to hold his hand in the air, continued to delay the charge. To the east, a barbarian screamed as he saw that his form was outlined suddenly by blue flames, magical fires that did not burn. They weren't truly harmless, though, for in the night they gave the man's position clearly away. The sound of many crossbows clicked from somewhere below, and the unfortunate barbarian cried out again and again, then he fell silent. That was more than enough for Berkthgar, and he hurled out the pellets. His nearby kin did likewise, and this second section of the south face brightened with magic. Down charged the men of Settlestone, to Besnel's continuing dismay. The riders should have gone down first, but not yet, not until the bulk of the enemy force had passed.
"We must,"
whispered the knight behind the elven leader from Silvery Moon, and Besnel quietly nodded. He surveyed the scene for just a moment, Berkthgar and his hundred were already engaged, straight down the face, with no hope of linking up with those brave men holding the high ground in the east. Despite his anger at the impetuous barbarian, Besnel marveled at Berkthgar's exploits. Mighty Bunkenfuera took out three kobolds at a swipe, launching them, whole or in parts, high into the air.
"The light will not hold," the knight behind Besnel remarked. "Between the two forces," Besnel replied, speaking loud enough so that all those riders around him could hear. "We must go down at an angle between the two forces so that the men in the east can escape behind us."
Not a word of complaint came back to him, though his chosen course was treacherous indeed. The original plan had called for the knights in silver to ride straight into the enemy, both from this position and the next position to the west, while Berkthgar and his men linked behind them, the whole of the defending force rolling gradually to the west. Now Berkthgar, in his bloodlust, had abandoned that plan, and the knights in silver might pay dearly for the act. But neither man nor elf complained. "Keep fast your pellets," Besnel commanded, "until the drow counter what light is already available." He reared his horse once, for effect. "For the glory of Silvery Moon," he cried.
"And the good of all good folk,"
came the unified response. Their thunder shook the side of Fourth Peak, resonated deep into the dwarven tunnels below the stone. To the blare of horns, down they charged, 100 riders, lances low, and when those long spears became entangled or snapped apart as they skewered the enemy, out came flashing swords. More deadly were the sturdy mounts, crushing kobolds under pounding hooves, scattering and terrifying kobolds and goblins and drow alike, for these invaders from the deepest Underdark had never seen such a cavalry charge. In mere minutes, the enemy advance up the mountain was halted and reversed, with only a few of the defenders taken down. And as the Dark Elves continued to counter the light pellets, Besnel's men countered their spells with still more light pellets. But the dark force continued its roll along the lower trails, evidenced by the blare of horns to the west, the calls to Tempest and to Longsaddle, and the renewed thunder as the Long Riders followed the lead of the knights in silver. The first real throw of magic led the charge from that third position, a lightning bolt from Regveld that split the darkness, causing more horror than destruction. Surprisingly, there came no magical response from the drow, other than minor darkness spells or fairy fire liming selected defenders. The remaining barbarian force did as the plan had demanded, angling between the Long Riders and the area just below the second position, linking up, not with the knights in silver, as was originally planned, but with Berkthgar and his force. High above the battle, Alustriel used all her discipline and restraint to hold herself in check. The defenders were, as expected, slicing the kobold and goblin ranks to pieces, killing the enemy in a ratio far in excess of 50-1. That number would have easily doubled had Alustriel loosed her magic, but she could not. The drow were waiting patiently, and she respected the powers of those evil elves enough to know that her first attack might be her only one. She whispered to the enchanted horses pulling the aerial chariot and moved lower, nodding grimly as she confirmed that the battle was going as anticipated. The slaughter high on the south face was complete, but the dark mass continued to flow below the struggle to the west. Alustriel understood that many drow were among the ranks of that lower group. The chariot swooped to the east, swiftly left the battle behind, and the Lady of Silvery Moon took some comfort in the realization that the enemy lines were not so long, not so far beyond the easternmost of the defensive positions. She came to understand why, when she heard yet another battle around the mountain to the east. The enemy had found Mithril Hall's eastern door, had entered the complex, and was battling the dwarves within. Flashes of lightning and bursts of fire erupted within the shadows of that low door, and the creatures that entered were not diminutive kobolds or stupid goblins. They were dark elves, many, many dark elves. She wanted to go down there, to rush over the enemy in a magical, explosive fury. But Alustriel had to trust in Brunner's people. The tunnels had been prepared, she knew, and the attack from outside the mountain had been expected. Her chariot flew on, around to the north, and Elustriel thought to complete the circuit, to cut low through Keeper's Dale in the east, where the other allies, another 100 of her knights in silver, waited. What she saw did not settle well, did not comfort her. The northern face of Fourth Peak was a treacherous, barren stretch of virtually unclimbable rock faces and broken ravines that no man could pass. Virtually unclimbable, but not to the sticky feet of giant subterranean lizards. Bergignon Béhenry and his elite force, the 400 famed lizard riders of House Béhenry, scrambled across that northern facing, making swift progress to the west toward Keeper's Dale. The waiting knights had been positioned to shore up the final defenses against the force crossing the southern face. Their charge, if it came, would be to open up the last flank, to allow Besnel, the Long Riders, and the men of Nesme and Settlestone to get into the dale, which was accessible through only one narrow pass. The Lizard Riders would get there first, Elustriel knew, and they outnumbered the waiting knights, and they were drow. The easternmost position was surrendered. The barbarians, or what remained of their ranks, ran fast to the west, crossing behind the knights in silver to join Berthgar. After they had crossed, Besnel turned his force to the west as well, pushing Berthgar's force, which had swelled to include nearly every living warrior from Settlestone, ahead. The leader of the knights in silver began to think that Berthgar's error would not be so devastating, that the retreat could proceed as planned. He found a high plateau and surveyed the area, nodding grimly as he noted that the enemy force below had rolled around the first three positions. Besnel's eyes widened, and he gasped aloud as he realized the exact location of the leading edge of that dark cloud. The riders of Nesme had missed their call. They had to get down the mountainside quickly to hold that flank, and yet for some reason they had hesitated, and the leading edge of the enemy force seemed beyond the fourth and last position. Now the riders of Nesme did come, and their full-out charge down the smoothest stone of the south face was indeed devastating, the 40 horsemen trampling thrice that number of kobolds in mere moments. But the enemy had that many to spare, Besnel knew, and many more beyond that. The plan had called for an organized retreat to the west, to Keeper's Dale, even in through Mithril Hall's western door if need be. It was a good plan, but now the flank was lost and the way to the west was closed. Besnel could only watch in horror. Part 5. Old Kings and Old Queens. They came as an army, but not so. 8,000 dark elves and a large number of humanoid slaves, a mighty and massive force, swarmed toward Mithril Hall. The descriptions are fitting in terms of sheer numbers and strength, and yet army and force imply something more. A sense of cohesion and collective purpose. Certainly the drow are among the finest warriors in the realms, trained to fight from the youngest age, alone or in groups. And certainly the purpose seems clear when the war is racial, when it is drow battling dwarves. Yet though their tactics are perfect, groups working in unison to support each other, that cohesion among drow ranks remains superficial. Few, if any, dark elves of Lolth's army would give her or his life to save another, unless she or he was confident that the sacrifice would guarantee a place of honor in the afterlife at the Spider Queen's side. Only a fanatic among the Dark Elves would take a hit, however minor, to spare another's life, and only because that fanatic thought the act in her own best interest. The drow came crying for the glory of the Spider Queen, but in reality, they each were looking for a piece of her glory. Personal gain was always the Dark Elves' primary precept. That was the difference between the defenders of Mithril Hall and those who came to conquer. That was the one hope of our side when faced with such horrendous odds, outnumbered by skilled drow warriors. If a single dwarf came to a battle in which his comrades were being overrun, he would roar in defiance and charge in headlong, however terrible the odds. Yet if we could catch a group of drow, a patrol perhaps in an ambush, Those supporting groups flanking their unfortunate comrades would not join in unless they could be assured of victory. We, not they, had true collective purpose. We, not they, understood cohesion, fought for a shared higher principle, and understood and accepted that any sacrifice we might make would be toward the greater good. There is a chamber, many chambers, actually, in Mithril Hall, where the heroes of wars and past struggles are honored. Wolfgar's hammer is there. So was the bow of an elf that Catti Bree put into service once more. Though she has used the bow for years, and has added considerably to its legend, Catti Bree refers to it still as the bow of an Ariel, that long-dead elf. If the bow is put into service again by a friend of Clan Battlehammer centuries hence, it will be called the Bow of Catti Bree, passed from an Ariel. There is in Mithril Hall another place, the Hall of Kings, where the busts of Clan Battlehammer's patrons, the 8 kings, have been carved, gigantic and everlasting. The drow have no such monuments. My mother, Malice, never spoke of the previous matron mother of House Doerden, likely because Malice played a hand in her mother's death. In the academy, there are no plaques of former mistresses and masters. Indeed, as I consider it now, the only monuments in Menzo Berenzon are the statues of those punished by Beenri, of those struck by Vendez and her wicked whip, their skin turned to ebony, that they might then be placed on display as testaments of disobedience on the plateau of Tir Bresh outside the academy. That was the difference between the defenders of Mithril Hall and those who came to conquer. That was the one hope. Drizzt Do'Urden. Chapter 23. Pockets of Power. Bitterdew had never seen anything to match it. Literally, it was raining kobolds and pieces of kobolds all around the terrified Harple as the Gutbuster Brigade went into full battle lust. They had come into a small, wide chamber and found a force of kobolds many times their own number. Before Bitterdew could suggest a retreat, or a tactical flanking maneuver, as he planned to call it, because he knew the word retreat was not in Thibeldorf Puent's vocabulary, Puent had led the forthright charge. Poor Bitterdew had been sucked up in the brigade's wake, the 7 frenzied dwarves blindly, happily following Puent's seemingly suicidal lead right into the heart of the cavern. Now it was a frenzy, a massacre, the likes of which the studious Harple, who had lived all his life in the sheltered Ivy Mansion, and a good part of that as a family dog, could not believe. Puent darted by him, a dead kobold impaled on his helmet spike and flopping limply. Arms wide, the battle rager leaped into a group of kobolds and pulled as many in as possible, hugging them tightly. Then he began to shake, to convulse so violently that Bitterdew wondered if some agonizing poison had found its way into the dwarf's veins. Not so, for this was controlled insanity. Puent shook, and the nasty ridges of his armor took the skin from his hugged enemies, ripped and tore them. He broke away, and 3 kobolds fell dying, with a left hook that brought his mailed, spiked gauntlet several inches into the forehead of the next unfortunate enemy. Bitterdew came to understand that the charge was not suicidal, that the Gutbusters would win easily by overwhelming the greater numbers with sheer fury. He also realized suddenly that the kobolds learned fast to avoid the furious dwarfs. 6 of them bypassed Puent, giving the battle rager a respectfully wide berth. 6 of them swung around and bore down on the one enemy they could hope to defeat. Bitterdew fumbled with the shattered remains of his spellbook, flipping to one page where the ink had not smeared so badly. Holding the parchment in one hand, his other hand straight out in front of him, he began a fast chant, waggling his fingers. A burst of magical energy erupted from each of his fingertips, green bolts rushing out, each darting and weaving to unerringly strike a target. 5 of the kobolds fell dead, and the 6th came on with a shriek, its little sword rushing for Bitterdew's belly. The parchment fell from the terrified Harple's hand. He screamed, thinking he was about to die, and reacted purely on instinct, falling forward over the blade, angling his chest down so that he buried the diminutive kobold beneath him. He felt a burning pain as the small creature's sword cut into his ribs, but there was no strength behind the blow, and the sword did not dig in deeply. Bitterdew, so unused to combat, screamed in terror, and the pain, the pain! Bitterdew's screams became a howl. He looked down and saw the thrashing kobold, and saw more clearly the thrashing kobold's exposed throat. Then he tasted warm blood and was not repulsed. Growling, Bitterdew closed his eyes and held on. The kobold stopped thrashing. After some time, the poor Harple noticed that the sounds of battle had ended around him. He gradually opened his eyes, turned his head slightly to look up at Thibbledorf Puent, standing over him and nodding his head. Only then did Bitterdew realize he had killed the kobold, had bitten the thing's throat out.
"Good technique," Puent offered,
and started away. While the Gutbuster Brigade's maneuvers were loud and straightforward, wholly dependent on savagery, another party's were a dance of stealth and ambush. Drizzt and Guinevere, Catti Bree, Regis and Brunner moved silently from one tunnel to another, the Drow and Panther leading. Guinevere was the first to detect an approaching enemy, and Drizzt quickly relayed the signals when the Panther's ears went flat. The five worked in unison, setting up so that Catti Bree, with her deadly bow, would strike first, followed by the Panther's spring, the Drow's impossibly fast rush into the fray, and Brunner's typically dwarven roaring charge. Regis always found a way to get into the fight, usually moving in behind to slam a Drow backside or a kobold's head with his mace when one of his friends became too closely pressed. This time, though, Regis figured to stay out of the battle altogether. The group was in a wide, high corridor when Guinevere, nearing a bend, fell into a crouch, ears flat. Drizzt slipped into the shadows of an alcove, as did Regis, while Brunner stepped defensively in front of his archer daughter so that Catti Bree could use the horns of his helmet to line up her shot. Around the corner came the enemy, a group of minotaurs and drow, five of each, running swiftly in the general direction of Mithril Hall. Catti Bree wisely went for the drow. There came a flash of silver, and one fell dead. Guinevere came out hard and fast, burying another dark elf, clawing and biting and rolling right away to bear down on a third drow. A second flash came, and another elf fell dead. But the minotaurs came on hard, and Catti Bree would get no third shot. She went for her sword as Brunner roared and rushed out to meet the closest monster. The minotaur lowered its bull-like head, and Brunner dropped his notched battle axe right behind him over his head, holding the handle tightly in both hands. In came the minotaur, and over came the axe. The crack sounded like the snapping of a gigantic tree. Brunner didn't know what hit him. Suddenly he was flying backward, bowled over by 600 pounds of minotaur. Drizzt came out spinning and darting. He hit the first minotaur from the side, a scimitar cutting deep into the back of the creature's thigh, stopping its charge. The ranger spun away and went down to one knee, jabbing straight ahead with Twinkle, hooking the tip of the blue-glowing scimitar over the next monster's kneecap. The minotaur howled and half fell, half dived right for Drizzt, but the drow's feet were already under him, already moving, and the brute slammed hard into the stone. Drizzt turned back for Catti Bree and Brunner, and the two remaining brutes bearing down on his friends. With incredible speed, he caught up to them almost immediately, and his scimitars went to work on one, again going for the legs, stopping the charge. But the last minotaur caught up to Catti Bree. Its huge club, made of hardened mushroom stalk, came flying around, and Catti Bree ducked fast, whipping her sword above her head. Cassitea sliced right through the club. And as the minotaur stared at the remaining piece dumbfoundedly, Catti Bree countered with a slashing backhand. The minotaur looked at her curiously. She could not believe she had missed. Regis watched from the shadows, knowing he was overmatched by any enemy in this fight. He tried to gauge his companions, though, wanting to be ready if needed. Mostly he watched Drizzt, mesmerized by the sheer speed of the drow's charges and dodges. Drizzt had always been quick afoot, but this display was simply amazing, the ranger's feet moving so swiftly that Regis could hardly distinguish them. More than once, Regis tried to anticipate Drizzt's path, only to find himself looking where the drow was not. For Drizzt had cut to the side, or reversed direction altogether, more quickly than the halfling would have believed possible. Regis finally just shook his head and filed his questions away for another time, reminding himself that there were other, more important considerations. He glanced around and noticed the last of the enemy drow slipping to the side, out of the way of the panther. The last drow wanted no part of Guinevere, and was glad indeed that the woman with the killing bow was engaged in close combat. Two of his dark elf companions lay dead from arrows, a third squirmed around on the floor, half her face torn away by the panther's claws, and all five minotaurs were down or engaged. The fourth drow had run off back around the bend, but that wicked panther was only a couple of strides behind, and the hiding dark elf knew his companion would be down in a matter of moments. Still, the drow hardly cared, for he saw Drizzt O'Erden, the renegade, the most hated. The ranger was fully engaged and vulnerable, working furiously to finish the three minotaurs he had wounded. If this drow could seize the opportunity and get Drizzt, then his place of glory and his house's glory would be sealed. Even if he was killed by Drizzt's friends, he would have a seat of honor beside Lolf, the Spider Queen. He loaded his most potent dart, a bolt enchanted with runes of fire and lightning, onto his heavy two-handed crossbow, an unusual weapon indeed for dark elves, and brought the sights in line. Something hit the crossbow hard from the side. The drow pulled the trigger instinctively, but the bolt, knocked loose, went nowhere but down, exploding at his feet. The jolt sent him flying, and the puff of flame singed his hair and momentarily blinded him. He rolled over on the floor and managed to get out of his burning powafwi. Dazed, he noticed a small mace lying on the floor, then a small plump hand reaching down to pick it up. The drow tried to react as the bare feet, hairy on top, something the underdark drow had never seen before, steadily approached. Then all went dark. Catty Bree cried out and leaped back, but the minotaur did not charge. Rather, the brute stood perfectly still, eyeing her curiously.
"I didn't miss," Catty Bree said,
as if her denial of what seemed obvious would change her predicament. To her surprise, she found she was right. The minotaur's left leg, severed cleanly by Kazidea's passing, caved in under it, and the brute fell sidelong to the floor, its lifeblood pouring out unchecked. Catty Bree looked to the side to see Brunner, grumbling and groaning, crawling out from under the minotaur he had killed. The dwarf hopped to his feet, shook his head briskly to clear away the stars, then stared at his axe, hands on hips, head shaking in dismay. The mighty weapon was embedded nearly a foot deep in the minotaur's thick skull.
"How in the nine hells am I going to get the damned thing out?" Brunner asked, looking at his daughter.
Drizzt was done, as was Regis, and Guinevere came back around the corner, dragging the last of the dark elves by the scruff of his broken neck.
"Another win for our side," Regis remarked as the friends regrouped.
Drizzt nodded his agreement, but seemed not so pleased. It was a small thing they were doing, he knew, barely scratching at the surface of the force that had come to Mithril Hall. And despite the quickness of this latest encounter, and of the three before it, the friends had been ultimately lucky. What would have happened had another group of drow or minotaurs or even kobolds come around the corner while the fight was raging? They had won quickly and cleanly, but their margin of victory was a finer line and a more tentative thing than the rout would indicate.
"You're not so pleased,"
Catty Bree said quietly to the ranger as they started off once more. "In 2 hours we have killed a dozen drow, a handful of minotaurs and a score of kobold fodder," Drizzt replied.
"With thousands more to go,"
the woman added, understanding Drizzt's dismay. Drizzt said nothing. His only hope, Mithril Hall's only hope, was that they and other groups like them would kill enough drow to take the heart from their enemy. Dark elves were a chaotic and supremely disloyal bunch, and only if the defenders of Mithril Hall could defeat the Drow army's will for the war did they have a chance. Guinevar's ears went flat again, and the panther slipped silently into the darkness. The friends, feeling suddenly weary of it all, moved into position and were relieved indeed when the newest group rambled into sight. No drow this time, no kobolds or minotaurs. A column of dwarves, more than a score, hailed them and approached. This group, too, had seen battle since the fight in Tunult's cavern. Many showed fresh wounds, and every dwarven weapon was stained with enemy blood.
"How fare we?"
Brunner asked, stepping to the front. The leader of the dwarven column winced, and Brunner had his answer.
"They're fighting in the Undercity, me king," said the dwarf. "How they got into the place, we're not for knowing. And fighting too in the upper levels, by all reports. The eastern door's been breached."
Brunner's shoulders visibly slumped.
"But we're holding at Garum's Gorge,"
the dwarf said with more determination.
"Where are ye from?
And where are ye going?"
Brunner wanted to know.
"From the last guard room,"
the dwarf explained.
"Come out in a short circuit to find yourself, me king. Tunnels are thick with drow scum, and glad we be to see you standing."
He pointed behind Brunner, then jabbed his finger to the left.
"We're not so far, and the way's still clear to the last guard room."
"But it won't be for long,"
another dwarf piped in glumly.
"And clear all the way to the Undercity from there," the leader finished.
Drizzt pulled Brunner to the side and began a whispered conversation. Catti Bree and Regis waited patiently, as did the dwarves.
"Keep searching," they heard Drizzt say.
"Me place is with me people," Brunner roughly replied. "And your own is with me."
Drizzt cut him short with a long stream of words. Catti Bree and the others heard snatches such as hunting the head and roundabout route, and they knew Drizzt was trying to convince Brunner to let him continue his hunt through the outer lower tunnels. Catti Bree decided then and there that if Drizzt and Guinevar were to go on, she, with her cat's eye circlet, which Elustriel had given her to allow her to see in the dark, would go with him. Regis, feeling unusually brave and useful, silently came to the same conclusion. Still, the two were surprised when Drizzt and Brunner walked back to the group.
"Get ye to the last guard room, and all the way to the Undercity if need be,"
Brunner commanded the column leader. The dwarf's jaw dropped with amazement.
"But, me king,"
he sputtered.
"Get ye,"
Brunner growled.
"And leave yourself alone out here,"
the stunned dwarf asked. Brunner's smile was wide and wicked as he looked from the dwarf to Drizzt, to Catti Bree, to Regis, and to Guinevar, then finally back to the dwarf.
"Alone,"
Brunner replied, and the other dwarf, knowing the prowess of his king's companions, conceded the point.
"Get ye back and win,"
Brunner said to him.
"Me and me friends got some hunting to do."
The two groups split apart once more, both grimly determined, but neither overly optimistic. Drizzt whispered something to the panther, and Guinevar took up the lead as before. To this point, the companions had been lying in wait for every enemy group that came their way. But now, with the grim news from the Undercity and the Eastern Door, Drizzt changed that tactic. If they could not avoid the small groups of drow and other monsters, then they would fight, but otherwise, their path now was more direct. Drizzt wanted to find the priestesses, and he knew it had to be priestesses who had led this march. The dwarves' only chance was to decapitate the enemy force. And so the companions were now, as Drizzt had quietly put it to Brunner, hunting the head. Regis, last in line, shook his head and looked more than once back the way the dwarven column had marched.
"How do I always get myself into this?"
the halfling whispered. Then, looking at the backs of his hearty, sometimes reckless friends, he knew he had his answer. Catti Bree heard the halfling's resigned sigh, understood its source, and managed to hide her smile. Chapter 24 Fiery Fury. Elustriel watched from her high perch, as the southern face of Fourth Beak flickered with light that seemed to be blinking like the stars above. The exchange of enchanted pellets from the defenders and countering dark magic from the invaders was furious. As she brought her chariot around the southwestern cliffs, the Lady of Silvery Moon grew terribly afraid, for the defenders had been pushed into a U formation, surrounded on all sides by goblins, kobolds, and fierce drow warriors. Still, the forces of the four armies fought well, practically back to back, and their line was strong. No great number could strike at them from the gap at the top of the U, the logical weak spot, because of the almost sheer cliffs, and the defenders were tightly packed enough along the entire line to hold against any concentrated assaults. Even as Elustriel fostered that thought, her hopes were put to the test. A group of goblins, led by huge bugbears, 7-foot hairy versions of goblins, formed into a tight diamond and spearheaded into the defenders' eastern flank. The line wavered, and Elustriel almost revealed herself with a flurry of explosive magic. But amidst the chaos and the press rose one sword above all others, one song above all others. Berkthgar the Bold, his wild hair flying, sang to Tempest with all his heart, and Bonkenfuera hummed as it swept through the air. Berkthgar ignored the lesser goblins and charged straight for the bugbears, and each mighty swipe cut one of them down. The leader of Settlestone took a vicious hit, and another, but no hint of pain crossed his stern visage or slowed his determined march. Those bugbears who escaped the first furious moments of the huge man's assault fled from him thereafter, and with their leaders so terrified, the goblins quickly lost heart for the press, and the diamond disintegrated into a fleeing mob. Many would be the songs to celebrate Berkthgar, Elustriel knew, but only if the defenders won. If the Dark Elves succeeded in their conquest, then all such heroics would be lost to the ages. All the songs would be buried beneath a black veil of oppression. That could not happen, the Lady of Silvery Moon decided. Even if Mithril Hall were to fall this night or the next, the war would not be lost. All of Silvery Moon would mobilize against the Drow, and she would go to Sundabar in the east, to Citadel Adbar, stronghold of King Harbram and his dwarves, and all the way to Waterdeep on the Sword Coast to muster the necessary forces to push the Drow back to Menzo Berenzon. This war was not lost, she reminded herself, and she looked down at the determined defenders holding against the swarm, fighting and dying. Then came the tragedy she had expected and feared all along. The magical barrage, bursts of fireballs and lightning, lines of consuming magical energy and spinning bolts of destruction. The assault focused on the southwestern corner of the U, blew apart the ranks of the riders of Nesme, consuming horse and man alike. Many humanoid slaves fell as well, mere fodder, and of no concern to the wicked drow wizards. Tears streamed down Elustriel's face as she watched that catastrophe, as she heard the agonized cries of man and beast, and saw that corner of the mountain become charred under the sheer power of the barrage. She berated herself for not foreseeing this war, for underestimating the intensity of the drow march, for not having her army fully entrenched, warriors, wizards, and priests alike, in the defense of Mithril Hall. The massacre went on for many seconds, seeming like hours to the horrified defenders. It went on and on, the explosions and the cries. Elustriel found her heart again and looked for the source, and when she saw it, she came to realize that the Dark Elf wizards, in their ignorance of the surface world, had erred. They were concentrated within a copse of thick trees, under cover, and hurling out their deadly volley of spells. Elustriel's features brightened into a wicked smile, a smile of vengeance, and she cut her chariot across at a sharp angle, swooping down the mountainside from on high, flying like an arrow for the heart of her enemies. The drow had erred. They were in the trees. As she crossed the northern edge of the battlefield, Elustriel cried out a command, and her chariot and the team of enchanted horses that pulled it ignited into bright flames. Below her she heard the cries of fear from friend and enemy alike, and she heard the trumpets from the knights in silver who recognized the chariot and understood that their leader had come. Down she streaked, a tremendous fireball leading the way, exploding in the heart of the copse.
Illustrial sped right to the tree's edge, then banked sharply and rushed along the thick line, the flames of her chariot igniting branches wherever she passed. The drow wizards had erred. She knew the dark elves had likely set up wards against countering magic, perhaps even over themselves, that would defeat even the most intense fires. But they did not understand the flammable nature of trees. Even if the fire did not consume them, the flames would blind them and effectively put them out of the fighting. And the smoke! The thick copse was damp from previous rains and frost, and billowing black clouds thickened the air. Even worse for the drow, the wizards countered as they had always countered fire, with spells creating water. So great was their response that the flames would have been quenched, except that Illustrial did not relent, continued to rush around the copse, even cut into the copse wherever she found a break. No water, not the ocean itself, could extinguish the fires of her enchanted chariot. As she continued to fuel the flames, the drenching spells by the wizards added steam to the smoke, thickened the air so that the dark elves could not see at all and could not breathe. Illustrial trusted in her horses, extensions of her will, to understand her intent and keep the chariot on course, and she watched, her spells ready, for she knew the enemy could not remain within the copse. As she expected, a drow floated up through the trees, rising above the inferno, levitating into the air and trying to orient himself to the scene beyond the copse. Illustrial's lightning bolt hit him in the back of the head and sent him spinning over and over, and he hung upside down and dead until his own spell expired, dropping him back into the trees. Even as she killed that wizard, though, a ball of flame puffed into the air right before the chariot, and the speeding thing and Illustrial with it plunged right through. The Lady of Silvery Moon was protected from the flames of her own spell, but not so from the fireball, and she cried out and came through pained, her face bright from burn. Higher up the mountainside, Besnel and his soldiers witnessed the attack against Illustrial. The elf steeled his golden eyes, and his men cried out in outrage. If their earlier exploits had been furious, they were purely savage now, and Berkthgar's men fighting beside them needed no prodding. Goblins and kobolds, bugbears and orcs, even huge minotaurs and skilled drow, died by the score in the next moments of battle. It hardly seemed to matter. Whenever one died, two took its place, and though the knights and the barbarians could have cut through the enemy lines, there was nowhere for them to go. Farther to the west, his own long riders similarly pressed. Regveld understood their only hope. He leaped Puddlejumper to a place where there were no enemies and cast a spell to send a message to Besnel.
"To the west," the wizard implored the knight leader.
Then Regveld took up the new lead and turned his men and the barbarians closest to them westward toward Keeper's Dale as the original plan had demanded. The drow wizards had been silenced, momentarily at least, and now was the only chance Regveld would have. A lightning bolt split the darkening air, a fireball followed, and Regveld followed that, leaping Puddlejumper over the ranks of his enemies and loosing a barrage of magical missiles below him as he flew. Confusion hit the enemy ranks, enough so that the Long Riders, men who had fought beside the Harples for all their lives and understood Regveld's tactics, were able to slice through, opening a gap. Beside them came many of the Settlestone warriors and the few remaining horsemen from Nesme. Behind them came the rest of the barbarian force and the knights in silver, mighty Berkthgar bringing up the rear, almost single-handedly keeping the pursuing monsters at bay. The defenders punched through quickly, but found their momentum halted as another force, mostly drow, cut across in front, forming thick ranks. Regveld continued his magical barrage, charged ahead with Puddlejumper, expecting to die. And so he would have, except that Illustrial, forced away from the copse by the increasingly effective counters of the drow wizards, rushed back up the mountainside, right along the dark elf line, low enough so that the drow who did not flee were trampled and burned by her fiery passing. Besnel and his men galloped to the front of the fleeing force, cried out to Illustrial and for the good of all goodly folk, and plunged into the confusion of the drow ranks, right into the flaming chariot's charred wake.
Many more men died in those few moments of hellish fighting, many men and many drow, but the defenders broke free to the west, ran and rode on, and found the path into Keeper's Dale before the enemy could block it. Above the battle once more, Elustriel slumped with exhaustion. She had not launched so concentrated a barrage of magic in many, many years, and had not engaged so closely in any conflict since the days before she had come to rule Silvery Moon. Now she was tired and wounded, burned and singed, and she had taken several hits by sword and by quarrel as she had rushed along the drow ranks. She knew the disapproval she would find when she returned to Silvery Moon, knew that her advisors and the city's council and colleagues from other cities would think her rash, even stupid. Mithril Hall was a minor kingdom, not worth her life, her detractors would say. To take such risks against so deadly an enemy was foolish. So they would say, but Elustriel knew better, knew that the freedoms and rights that applied to Silvery Moon were not there simply because of her city's size and strength. They applied to all, to Silvery Moon, to Waterdeep, and to the smallest of kingdoms that so desired them, because otherwise the values they promoted were meaningless and selfish. Now she was wounded, had nearly been killed, and she called off her chariot's flames as she rose high into the sky. To show herself so openly would invite a continuing magical attack that would likely destroy her. She was sorely wounded, she knew, but Elustriel was smiling. Even if she died this night, the Lady of Silvery Moon would die smiling, because she was following her heart. She was fighting for something bigger than her life, for values that were eternal and ultimately right. She watched with satisfaction as the force, led by Besnel and her own knights, broke free and sped for Keeper's Dale. Then she climbed higher into the cold sky, angling for the west. The enemy would pursue, and more enemies were coming fast around the north, and the battle had only just begun. The Undercity, where 2,000 dwarves often labored hard at their most beloved profession, had never seen such bustle and tumult as this day. Not even when the Shadow Dragon Shimmergloom and its host of evil gray dwarves had invaded, when Brunner's grandfather had been king, had the Undercity been engulfed in such a battle. Goblins and minotaurs, kobolds and wicked monsters that the dwarves could not name, flooded in from the lower tunnels and through the floor itself, areas that had been breached by the magic of the Illithids. And the drow, scores of dark elves, struggled and battled along every step and across the wide floor, their dance a macabre mix of swirling shadows in the glow of the many low-burning furnaces. Still, the main tunnels to the lower levels had not been breached, and the greatest concentration of enemies, particularly the drow force, remained outside Mithril Hall proper. Now the dark elves who had gained the Undercity meant to open that way, to link up with the forces of Yutha Gentol and Matron Bayenri. And the dwarves meant to stop them, knowing that if that joining came to pass, then Mithril Hall would be lost. Lightning flashed, green and red and sizzling black bolts from below, from the drow, and it was answered from above by Harkel and Belladon Delroy. The lowest levels began to grow darker, as the drow worked their magic to gain a favorable battlefield. The fall of light pellets upon the floor sounded like a gentle rain, as Stumpet Rakingclaw and her host of dwarven priests countered the magic, brightening the area, loading spell after spell, stealing every shadow from every corner. Dwarves could fight in the dark, but they could fight in the light as well, and the drow and other creatures from the Underdark were not so fond of brightness. One group of 20 dwarves formed a tight formation on the wide floor and rolled over a band of fleeing goblins. Their boots sounded like a heavy rolling wheel, a general din mowing over whatever monster dared to stay in their path. A handful of dark elves fired stinging crossbow quarrels, but the dwarves shook off the hits, and since their blood ran thick with potions to counter any poisons, they shook off the infamous drow sleeping drug as well. Seeing that their attack was ineffective, the drow scattered, and the dwarven wedge rolled toward the next obstacle, two strange-looking creatures that the bearded folk did not know, two ugly creatures with slimy heads that waved tentacles where the mouths should have been, and with milky white eyes that showed no pupils. The dwarven wedge seemed unstoppable, but when the Illithids turned their way and loosed their devastating mental barrage, the wedge wobbled and fell apart, stunned dwarves staggering aimlessly.
Oh, there they are! Harkle squealed from the third tier of the Undercity, more than 60 feet from the floor. Bella Don Delroy's face crinkled with disgust as she looked at Mind Flayers for the first time. She and Harkle had expected the creatures. Drizzt had told them about Matron Bayenry's pet. Despite her disgust, Bella, like all Harples, was more curious than afraid. The Illithids had been expected. She just hadn't expected them to be so damned ugly.
"Are you sure of this?"
the diminutive woman asked Harkle, who had devised the strategy for fighting the squishy-headed things. Her good eye revealed her true hopes, though, for while she talked to Harkle,